Hello everyone and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Saba Kassa. I'm a Senior Public Governance Specialist at the Basel Institute on Governance, and I'm pleased to be with you today to moderate today's event on using social norm and behavior change approaches to address corruption and tackle illegal wildlife trade. We look forward to a very lively discussion with you, so please therefore leave all your comments and questions in the Q&A function that you'll find on the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. So in today's webinar, we'll hear from Claudia Baez-Camargo, Head of Public Governance at the Basel Institute on Governance, and Gail Burgess, Behavior Change Program Leader at TRAFFIC, about their recently published research on the evidence and potential application of social norms and behavior change approaches to address corruption and tackle illegal wildlife trade. Following their inputs, we'll hear reflections from our discussions, Sabri Zain, Director of Policy at TRAFFIC, and Robert Lugolobi, Independent Consultant and Anti-Corruption Expert, joining us from Uganda. Without further ado, let me give the floor to you, Claudia, to share the findings from the problem analysis and state of the field review on the behavioral drivers, corruption facilitating the illegal wildlife.
Sorry. Okay, so happy to be here with you and to mark this occasion where we are launching our new working paper. And here I could not resist the temptation to share with you what it looks like, because it's such a beautifully designed paper that Gail and I have co-authored, and really happy to have this collaboration between Basel Institute and TRAFFIC take shape in this way. So basically, what we've done, we have undertaken this study, and I'll give you a little bit of background why we are focusing on this topic and why this study came about. So we all know that corruption is one of those key factors that enables environmental crime. We also know that corruption is resilient and it's difficult to eradicate. So as of recently, there's increasing evidence that shows how so-called behavioral drivers, so things like having to do with social norms or certain preconceptions or stereotypes, incentivize and perpetuate patterns of corrupt behaviors. So this insight has increased the interest on, okay, so how can we develop anti-corruption interventions that target social norms and that promote behavior change? So so-called social norm and behavior change interventions. And so there's a lot of interest, but there's also, I would say, a lack of clear guidance on how to apply this type of approach to the field of anti-corruption. We know that SMBC approaches hold a great deal of promise, but they are not a silver bullet. They are not the key to get rid of corruption in and of themselves. And they may not always be fit for purpose. We need to know when an SMBC approach is granted and is likely to be effective. So our working paper is one of those steps towards developing in-depth guidance for practitioners that TNRC is actively promoting. So just a little bit about what we did. Our aim was to review what is the evidence out there on how these so-called behavioral drivers of corruption spur or facilitate illegal wildlife trade, and to understand what works and what doesn't in fighting this kind of corruption, and also to identify entry points for designing interventions that can effectively reduce IWG-related corruption. So to do that, we did a very extensive literature review. So we looked at over 100 documents. We also looked at what 35 stakeholders and initiatives have been doing, what kind of approaches and with what kind of results they have implemented. And we also conducted in-depth key expert interviews. So I think that one of the main insights coming out of this exercise is that the space, the opportunity space where corruption can happen across the IWT chain is huge. So in the gray box at the top, we just listed a indicative number of stakeholders that in principle can be engaging or can be vulnerable to corruption risks from illegal wildlife trafficking rings. And the types of corruption can be varied. So we can talk about bribery, patronage, state capture, extortion, and also what is the corruption aiming at? Corruption can be functional and can be instrumental to a great many things, to allow access to wildlife, for example, to leak intelligence about monitoring and patrols, to misdeclare species, to turn a blind eye on monitoring and inspections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, what we're talking about is a very broad area where corruption risks can emerge involving a large number of stakeholders. So one of the first things to understand then to make this practitioner relevant is that we need to try to do a rigorous diagnosis as to what are the types of corruption that matter here. So what are the concrete instances, practices, risks? What are the behaviors that are relevant to enable IWT and that are concrete enough that we can actually sit down and design interventions to tackle them? So this is really a call to move away from generalizing and assuming corruption risks, but rather we need to identify what are concrete typologies, what are concrete patterns that are associated to the illegal trafficking of wildlife goods in specific regions, in specific contexts. The second step to make this actionable is to understand what are the drivers behind the identified corruption practices. So basically what this means is what are those elements that are incentivizing or generating the corruption risks and the corruption behaviors ultimately. And in our field, we normally make a distinction between four different categories of drivers of corruption. So one is a principal agent idea, meaning that corruption arises because of a problem in a principal agent relationship. So this has to do with things like lack of monitoring, lack of strict enough criminalization, enforcement of the rules, and so on. So these are law enforcement, but also monitoring-based approaches. But corruption can also arise out of collective action problems. So if everybody is believing everybody else is corrupt, then the logical or even the rational solution is to engage in corruption as well, so as not to be on the losing side. The third one is functionality of corruption. What this means is that corruption often is very useful to solve specific problems. So unless we understand what is the problem that is lying underneath a particular corrupt behavior, is difficult to deal with. A typical example, for example, corruption that happens in the provision of public services typically arises because there's too much demand for scarce services. So just a few health workers that have to look after a large number of patients. And then corruption becomes the way to jump the queue and to solve the problem at hand that I need to see a doctor, but I don't want to stand in line for a really long time. And then the behavioral drivers are what I was mentioning before, things to do with social norms, when corruption is socially accepted and expected, or also things like mental models, like stereotypes. If we believe that all law enforcement officials are corrupt, we're going to behave in a manner different than if we believe the opposite. So we need to understand what kind of driver is at play in any particular problem of corruption. Of course, a complicating factor is that often the different types of drivers may be intertwined in particular contexts. So in this graphic, what I want to show you is that in what we've learned about how IWT happens, corruption takes place often because it is instrumental. It helps, you know, for the trafficking chain to function more effectively. So it's about things like avoiding detection, expediting shipments, falsifying permits, but also, you know, for some of the people on the ground who are involved in the trafficking, it's also about making ends meet. So if there is not a solution to the own livelihood that is available, but there is an offer to participate in this kind of trafficking, then a low-level public official might be more prone to receive a bribe because of this making ends meet kind of consideration. And this functionality, these instrumental considerations often take place in contexts where there are other drivers at place already. So not surprisingly, some of the countries that are hubs for the illegal trafficking of wildlife also have weak governance issues. So laws that are not adequately implemented, or even the legal frameworks might be inadequate themselves. Corruption as a collective action problem, where if everybody believes that corruption is endemic, nobody has really an incentive to stop, as well as behavioral drivers, where social norms, such as those of reciprocity, gift-giving, obligation to the group, come into play into incentivizing and then locking in behaviors that make the acceptability of corruption. So basically then, the question is, we need to understand what are the drivers and what are those elements in the context that are giving rise to the corrupt behaviors. Once we do this, and one of the next things that we did in a problem analysis was to understand, okay, so what do we know about what has been tried to tackle the corruption that incentivizes IWT, and what is the relative effectiveness of the different types of approaches? And one of the key findings is that really there are not that many anti-corruption, anti-IWT interventions. So most of the interventions that are tackling illegal wildlife trafficking have not any considerations linked to corruption, and therefore also not taking into account the social norms and behavioral aspects of the corruption that we're interested in. So in terms of what conclusions or what were the emerging insights that came overall from the study, one is that we need more nuanced and precise evidence on why, where, and how exactly corruption arises in the form of regularized patterns of behaviors that fuel IWT. So we know and we suspect that corruption risks are there and that corruption materializes. But to make the, you know, to make the considerations to actually design interventions to tackle these problems, we need to also be very clear about what these problems look like. So we need to talk about, you know, are we talking about bribery among specific public officials and the traffickers? In which country? At what level? We need to go to this level of granularity to understand what it is that we're up against and therefore what we can do about it. A second consideration was that there is not a lot of evidence as to what works. And this is not for lack of programs that have tackled IWT and have tried to deal with the corruption around it, but it's more about lack of monitoring and evaluation, or a lack of good impact evaluation mechanisms to understand, okay, if we have taken this approach, to what extent have we achieved our goals of decreasing corruption, of decreasing illegal wildlife flows? So there is a need And this is, I suppose, a call for the practitioners to really take seriously the issue of monitoring and evaluation of their own initiatives, because we need to construct an evidence base. And so before we can make an assessment of what works and what doesn't, we need to build the evidence based on concrete experiences of many of the ongoing programs that are out there working in this field. The final thing we did in this paper was to come up with a framework to identify intervention entry points. And this is based on considerations of impact and feasibility, and I'll speak about that in a second. What does this mean? Across the four key areas of the IWT chain. So these are the source, the end markets, the trafficking, and cross-cutting the policy, which encompasses law enforcement, prevention, prevention, and cuts across the other three. So in terms of prioritizing, we suggest that it's important to prioritize in terms of impact. So this means for each context, there is always a plethora of corruption challenges that one could invest in addressing. The question is, where should we be spending our energies and our resources that will yield the greatest impact, that will create the biggest change in the direction that we want to see? So impact refers precisely to this. And the call is to, you know, it is worth it investing in making detailed assessments to understand what are the different problems of IWT-related corruption, and what is the relative impact to assess where it is worthwhile to spend resources in developing and testing interventions. And the second consideration is feasibility. And this is, you know, recognizing pragmatically that there are some problems of corruption, and there are some areas where it's, you know, it's going to require long-term sustained effort to achieve results, whether there might be other instances where there might be low-hanging fruit that can be targeted. So it is a call for practitioners to, you know, to put these things in a balance and to make their programming decisions with consideration that is, am I going to have an impact enough, and is the problem that I'm trying to address feasible enough that I can, achieve the goals of my program or of my activities as intended. And then finally, this is what the framework looks like. And like I said, it's looking at these four key areas in the IWT chain: the source, that's where the poaching, of course, that's where the animals are; the trafficking, the transport, how the goods get from the source to the end markets where the consumption happens, and then the policy. And here, basically, the idea is in each stage to have a look at who are the actors that are involved and what are the problems of corruption that we know of might be happening in this area and what might be the drivers. So very quickly, if we look at the source side of things, what we know is that very often need is an important driver, where questions about subsistence might incentivize or make people vulnerable to giving in to corruption. And these risks are often accompanied by social norms and understandings that reinforce and make this behavior acceptable. So in this case, one would say, yes, it might be important to adopt a social norm or behavior change approach, but it will not be enough unless we look at the root cause that has to do with subsistence. So making this kind of consideration can help us frame an intervention that is looking at alternative livelihoods, for example, but incorporating a social norm approach as a complement to reinforce the outcome that we want to achieve. So this is a taste of what's the logic behind this framework is, but I'm going to leave it here because I know that Gail is going to elaborate a little bit more in detail on what it means to apply this framework. So this is my segue to say over to Gail. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Great to have everything, the huge body of evidence that's in the problem analysis so succinctly. Hopefully everybody can see my slides. Okay, so I'm going to give some illustration of how the framework can be applied to combat illegal wildlife trade related corruption. And I have 10 slides or so, so I'm going to try and do this in 10 minutes to enable us to hear from our discussants and to have a good discussion around the topic from our audience. I'm going to structure the slides by looking at each three of the four stages the framework covers. So starting with corruption at source, where the framework identified actors as poachers, rangers, and local communities, and thinking about some of the drivers such as poverty, social norms, and mental models. Recognizing that the analysis identified low to medium potential for social norm and behavior change initiatives to make a significant contribution to combating corruption at this stage. Going to discuss some examples that traffickers identified through research conducted with 73 wildlife trade offenders that were convicted and placed in 25 institutions in South Africa. We conducted this research in 2019, 2020, and produced a couple of reports that the links to which are in the graphic at the bottom of the screen there. Although most people think of pums and pangolins, potentially also big cats, when they think of South Africa and poaching issues, actually our engagement in these wildlife trade offender interviews, revealed and really reinforced for us the huge volume of different species impacted by illegal trade in wildlife in countries such as this. So a really good example is the abalone trade. Over 96 million abalone have been extracted in the decade 2006 to 2016, which has led to a 35% drop in the population of wild abalone available on the shores of South Africa. This is a marine mollusk, for those that don't know. Cycads as well. A lot of people in South Africa, this supplies a largely domestic market in South Africa. Cycads, one of the most threatened group of flora in particular in the world. 12 are listed as critically endangered and 3 are extinct in the wild. And there are 38 species that are endemic to South Africa. They're indigenous to that country. And it seemed very much as a status symbol to have one. So they largely supply a domestic market, unlike abalone and rhino, which are largely for export overseas, in particular Eastern and Southeast Asian markets. So corrupt practices at source in particular involve bribes in order to get access to populations of these protected species of fauna and flora. And all of the commodities that are acquired from those are high value. So in particular, in the context of situations of high poverty in rural communities, there's a lot of drive there to engage in these forms of illegal corruption. And 41% of those that were interviewed through this study actually reported corruption as one of the key enablers for getting them into illegal wildlife trade in the first place. It was quite a high proportion. The issue is really complex. I drew out this quote in the bottom of the screen on the left to illustrate how actually issues such as state capture also are sometimes evident or alleged to be, as demonstrated through this comment from interviewee 60, who commented that the abalone is exported to Asia and Asian nationals by the legal abalone, but also the illegal species too, claimed from when material that's confiscated is resold on. So it's a very kind of complex set of issues, which really illustrates the type of scenarios we were uncovering when we went through the literature review at the early stage of the problem analysis. So how do we tackle this? So some simple entry points identified by looking at tools that can both help to penalise corruption where it occurs and prevent it from happening through punitive measures, thinking about controls in particular, and also considering the elements that might be directed a bit more towards persuasive tactics. So in simple language, carrots and sticks. And thinking as well about the levels the ROSE really kind of try to distinguish between initiatives that would target individuals and think about personal changes in behaviour, but then also the social norms side of it that Claudia really touched upon through her slides, thinking about the tolerance towards corruption and how that facilitates continued engagement in corrupt acts. Some examples here, none of these relate to this specific set of findings that we had in South Africa, as Claudia has kind of introduced already. It's just quite hard to come up with exact examples already. So on the top left box there, this relates to the guerrilla organisation's work to prevent poaching from occurring in areas where there's already high prevalence of poaching occurring. And this initiative in particular relates to mountain gorilla protection. It was set up as a legacy initiative from Dr. Diane Fossey's work, for those that have heard of her. And these participants are given exchange for ending their illegal snares, their machetes and their rifles. And if they take an oath to say that they're not going to engage in corruption anymore, they will basically be given a small portion of land so that they can engage in organic farming, tree planting, beekeeping initiatives. And this has been hugely successful in getting people out of poverty whilst also reducing the incidences of poaching where the mountain gorillas live. Initiatives that kind of transcend both self and society include things like a pedal-powered community cinema and additional broader media outreach at the society level, so transit to the bottom right of the screen, where groups like Population Media Centre are already delivering quite exciting initiatives that build on what's called education entertainment. And these kind of try to address very complicated social and conservation issues through adapting storylines, using existing storylines typically that are already popular in different societies and cultures that we're trying to engage in discussion around these issues. And kind of adapting the storyline so that a hero character is shown to kind of go through the transition towards the desired behaviour. And Population Media Centre did actually deliver an initiative focused on protection of mountain gorillas alongside population lifestyle issues. And it was found at the end of that 312 kind of series of editions that were broadcast between 2006 and 2009, I believe, the first time, and then they were rebroadcast later. Listeners were 3.4 times more likely to say they supported the protection of gorillas and their habitat, and recognise that it can reduce poverty and bring tourists to local areas. So the persuasive tactics, going back to the self, there's a few of these kind of reformed poachers initiatives springing up in different parts of Africa in particular at the moment. They could appear elsewhere. The gentleman showing on the graphic on the top right is Luca Chinua, and he was a poacher when at 25 years old. He became the principal breadwinner for his family when his father, who had been in the army, was killed, and he was left to find ways to fend for himself and his family. So quite a classic illustration, a tragic illustration of how people are forced into this reality. He would regularly go into the bush. He would get $15 for poaching a buffalo. He targeted buffalo, but it carried a lot of risks. It was very intermittent income for him. It was very dangerous. Apparently, black mamba are very prevalent in the areas in Zambia where he was going into. And so when he was finally caught and facing a custodial sentence for engaging in illegal poaching, Game Rangers International approached him and asked him if he would be interested to retrain with them as a reformed poacher and become kind of a warden for elephants in particular. So 12 years on after this exchange, he's now the longest standing member of that group. And they collectively have caught and apprehended over 1,000 poachers locally. They do some really exciting work. And he's in this particular row because part of his work is to really champion anti-corruption, rejection of bribes, trying to get community members to recognise that wildlife actually represents, you know, a fantastic source of income and a regular source of income, which he explains to people really transformed his life. So that personal story of transition towards the desired behaviour has been critical in him achieving success. Of course, alongside all of this, it's really important to recognise how society should be enabled to report corruption where it happens, which is the final box on the bottom left. And important to know that if they do report corrupt acts, that they will be taken seriously and protected from harm. And there are a number of initiatives being driven forward. This is a South Africa relevant case study to try to address that issue. Still some way to go, as we know, but it kind of illustrates the issues that Claudia was mentioning in her slides. So trafficking and thinking about policy links, in the framework, trafficking actually was the one stage where minimal potential for social norms and behaviour change was identified. But one of the case studies we also identified from the Wildlife Trade Offender Research was some of the offenders saying that they had experienced corruption in the judicial process, although they were alleging that to have occurred with others. So the example was given that you can pay a bribe to escape criminal conviction, jail time or financial penalties. And obviously they had not been able to do that because they were in jail, but they had heard that that was possible. And this is another way in which corruption kind of really undermines other actions to combat illegal wildlife trade. If it's not taken seriously or if you can pay your way out of trouble, you know, it really creates huge problems and undermines other action. So this insights from the incarcerated report kind of digs into that a little bit more deeply, looking here in particular at abalone and the role of drivers that and traffickers and how they're involved, thinking about how you can really kind of ensure the convictions are carried through, custodial sentences do arrive. And what's the role of social norms and behaviour change amongst that work? Some really exciting initiatives being driven around the world in this field, actually. So thinking about, you know, very obviously it would be necessary to make sure prosecutors are charged with taking bribes where that does occur. The example that's up there is in Georgia, inter-policing in Georgia. So not relevant to the region, but, you know, lots of opportunity to make sure that where that does occur, prosecutions do happen. It's actually really an important part of social norm and behaviour change work to show that there are consequences for engaging in the bad behaviour. And this is common sense to many of us, I'm sure. Thinking a little bit more about evolving from punitive measures through to carrots. The persuasive tactics really getting some momentum now are building on what's called the Bangalore principles of judicial conduct. Perhaps some of those of you on the call will already be aware of these. They were first postulated in 2006, they've been upgraded in 2018, and they're trying to encourage judiciary to actually state and develop things like codes of conduct, codes of ethics. Really, really interesting webinar that I've put the link to there. We don't really have time to talk about it in depth today. But if you're interested to do this and interested to get some tips about how and some real world experience, Senior Justice for the Caribbean, Adrian Saunders talks about his experience of trying to introduce this there. And it's a 15-minute overview that I found really interesting when I listened to it. So I would recommend that. Thinking about some good examples of how you reduce the kind of society's expectation to do things like pay bribes and to increased transparency in relation to the judicial practice in particular. This has been found to be really important in strengthening preventative measures, trying to ensure there's independence in the judicial process and that there's segregation between some of the steps involved in taking cases through to court and to successful conclusion in court. Obviously, court case tracking is another way in which increased transparency and traceability can be applied very rigorously to ensure there's public accountability to prevent bribery and other forms of corruption occurring. Similarly, really interesting initiative that I really like is the Zero Repeat Note, introduced by Fifth Pillar, which is an NGO in India. And it basically enables those that are asked to pay a bribe to hand over this note, which says, "I promise to neither accept nor give a bribe." And it's achieved quite a lot of positive progress in India and in enabling people to show their rejection, societal rejection of paying bribes. All the links are provided for those that like more information. Finally, moving quickly through to conclusion, thinking about corruption end markets. This was the only area actually in the framework where it seemed to suggest the potential for social norm and behaviour change interventions in their own right could be quite high. That's based, of course, on lots of work at the moment to apply these approaches to demand reduction initiatives. And I know there's some on the call that have lots of experience of this. Whether it's also got strong potential for corruption involved in that remains to be seen. We've kind of based our assessment on the strong potential evidence for reducing things like corporate gifting of high value products. Two examples here to move again a bit away from the usual suspects of pachyderms, pangolins and big cats. This is relevant to a lot more species than those which are typically featured in the media headlines. So the example of ginseng here and also cordyceps, which is the fungus that grows inside the caterpillar. These are really high value commodities from non-timber forest products. And often they're sort of considered to be used as bribes, lavish gifts for themselves. We've published a paper on this that's available on the TNRC website. The link is available there if you'd like to understand a little bit more about how these are used. Thinking about, again, the role of social norm and behaviour change solutions, here it's much more clear that there could be approaches. So the distinction between self and society I've kind of removed here because it's they kind of blend into one a little bit. But to take Vietnam as a really interesting case study at the moment, China and Vietnam have had very significant anti-graft campaigns led by their governments. China's started some years back now, but Vietnam started in around 2016. And it's been in the news earlier this year because it's moved out of crackdowns on public officials into now the private sector, and this has led to a real disruption in the markets in Vietnam, where two very senior and very large real estate kind of firms, their CEOs were convicted of fraud and other types of corrupt acts. This offers a lot of opportunity, I think, to send a clear message to Vietnamese society that the government is, in particular, the Ministry of Public Security, is really trying to get on top of the levels of corruption that in the past have seemed endemic in Vietnamese different sectors. And Blazing Furnace, there are lots of good hooks that are available to shift from that penalties, prosecution across to a bit more of the persuasion. In 2018, there was an anti-corruption law brought in, which requires all companies in Vietnam to develop codes of conduct and additional measures that show company leadership against corruption and to reduce the expectation of this being a societal or even corporate norm in you know, everyday practice in business in Vietnam. For example, the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce and Industry is really strong. We've done quite a lot of work with them in the past. They do relate to the International Chamber of Commerce, And there are some good kind of guidance on that website about how you can, as a company, kind of take a bit more of a proactive stance with your staff and with your suppliers around things like codes of integrity, getting individual staff members to commit to that, making it an explicit part of engagement. With society, there's been some strong trends evidence. I've run out of time probably already, but a great report that's linked there, produced by Indochina Research. They've conducted these routine assessments of Vietnamese society. In the most recent study, a significant jump up from previous studies, 71% of those surveyed said that they felt they had a role to play in combating corruption and that they were willing to do things like refuse to pay bribes or to report corrupt acts where they occur. But unfortunately, only one in two said that they had no fear of personal consequences, which creates real challenges for, you know, how you move forward with re-establishing some social norms around this. It's a very rapid run through. These are intended to give an illustration of how you might proceed. I do hope we get more time for discussion. Some consistent ingredients for success with social norm and behaviour change approaches. Thinking about the enabling environment and just making sure you've got great insight and understanding into all of the factors that influence both the what we would call the bad behaviour and the desirable behaviour. Making sure that you're clear about who you're targeting. Don't just issue kind of blanket communications and expect those to educate and inform the public and that to achieve change. Use persuasive tactics and messaging where possible. Ground it in a clear framework and theory. Make sure you consider who your messengers are and the types of message frame that you use. Try to adopt a positive frame rather than just instill a sense of doom in people. It's quite disabling. And make sure you adapt your message over time. There's more on these topics on our website course available for those that are interested. And this is all intended to complement the problem analysis that we're here to share with you today. So thank you very much and handing back to Saba. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Gail. Thank you very much also, Claudia, for sharing more about your research, the various approaches, anchors to adopt, but also the very practical examples that you've given us of how to put this framework into action. Let me invite our audience members to please share with us your questions or comments, having heard Gail and Claudia speak about their research, pointed feedback you have for them. So without further ado, let us move over and continue hearing from our two discussants to reflect on the practical implications of some of the research findings. Sabri, Director of Policy at Traffic, let us please start with you. And could you share some more light about what could be examples of how these findings can be practically applied that you see from your position and work? What are some of the priorities to tackle IWT-related corruption through the use of social norms and behavior change approaches? And what barriers do you see and how could we overcome them? Thank you.
Thanks, Abba. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that corruption is one of the most significant facilitators of legal and unsustainable wallet trade. But corruption can take many different forms, ranging from, for example, the issuing of fraudulent hunting permits or issuing of fraudulent export permits to corporate gifting at the demand reduction side. Or illicit financial flows. So each of these different forms of corruption is driven by quite different behaviors. It's done by quite different actors. So there's no one size fits all approach to addressing corruption within illegal trade. So that I think the findings of this report gives us the opportunity to see how we can look at these different forms of corruption, what approaches we need to take, who are the different actors we need to address. And I think that would make these anti-corruption efforts all that more effective. And addressing corruption within the illegal wildlife trade sphere has so far focused on awareness of legislative or regulatory or administrative actions. It really hasn't looked at how to tackle the behaviors that lead to this corruption. So hopefully these findings will help in the development of training programs that can take into account, you know, social behavior approaches that are effective. I think we really need to take advantage of the fact that there are some really significant policy initiatives that are making it ideal for us to address corruption within the illegal wildlife trade sphere right now. So within the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, within CITES, the convention that addresses international wildlife crime, there are two developments now that are absolutely relevant. Right now, for example, we have, for the first time ever, a resolution within CITES that specifically addresses anti-corruption and encouraging commitments from governments to implement anti-corruption actions to address illegal wildlife crime. So corruption is no longer a taboo word within the wildlife crime era. The other development is that there's also greater recognition within CITES to using social behavior change approaches as an agent of change, going beyond awareness and posters and billboards, and using exactly the kind of structured social behavior approaches that Claudia and Gail talked about in the findings. So the enabling environment is just right for us to implement these different approaches that we talked about in the past half hour. Now, I think Claudia mentioned evidence-based in her presentation, and I think a key priority for us is to get that evidence base to identify, for example, who are the different target audiences that we need to talk to? Which are these actors where we can have the most impact? Is it the frontline staff at the point of entry to a country? Is it the decision maker who issues the CITES permits? Is it the audience in the private sector, whether in for example, in the transport sector that facilitates some of this corruption? And then once you've identified those different actors, what are the motivations, the attitudes, and the behaviors that we want to address? And what is the messaging that we want to deliver to these people in order to make them change their behaviors? And we really need to look at all the different actors, not just how to change the behaviors of the perpetrators, but also how do we encourage whistleblowers and others within the organization to be able to be more aware of corrupt practices and report these practices to people. Behaviors, as both our presenters said, it's not just a matter of making ends meet sometimes. Sometimes is it part of the organizational culture that these practices are so prevalent? And in which case, what's the messaging that we need to deliver? Who are the people that we need to deliver these messages? It may not necessarily be the people at the top. It could be other champions of anti-corruption that we want to use in order to influence more zero tolerant behavior towards corruption. And I think one other thing we need to take into account is evaluation. I don't think any of our speakers mentioned evaluation, but it's absolutely essential that as we develop these approaches, as we identify these target audiences and the messages, how do we evaluate these approaches so that we know we're going in the right direction and we're doing the right things? And how do we adapt to ensure that we're taking the right approach, or whether we should change that approach towards a different actor or towards a different towards different behaviors. Finally, I think one in terms of barriers, I'm a wildlife trait specialist. I'm not a social behavior change expert. And you know, to do this kind of work, you do need social behavior change experts. And one thing we found in trying, trying to encourage behavioral change approaches in demand reduction is that there's this general feeling that this is a social behavior change is an area of work that is well beyond expertise of most people involved in managing natural resources. So we have to make sure that we bring in the right experts in the field, and that there's a commitment to investing in social behavior change experts who can do the job properly with the advice and in consultation with some of the natural resource managers.
Thank you very much, Sabri. So very, very interesting to hear your reflections. Let me give the floor to Robert. Robert, coming from the perspective as an anti-corruption expert, can you give us some your ideas, your insights on what would be the relevance and the usefulness of the report findings for you, and what are some of the programming implications you see?
Thank you, Sabah, and thank you for all the listeners and the previous presenter. I think this framework is a good one. It's informative, but also it gives good insight. For example, social norms and corruption. I think that's a very interesting topic as to really respect to understand how things happen and why things happen. And I mean, understanding the causes, the root causes of whatever we see. For example, in this framework, the social norms, how the rest are expected to, the corrective action, how the rest are expected to behave when faced with the same challenges. I think that's one very critical, because if I expect that my neighbor, my friend, and my brother will pick the money, will pick a bribe on this, then chances are probably 90% that I will do the same, because probably there are also other circumstances or reasons why that has come to a level where everyone is expected to do it. So I think that one is very critical, and that normative norm is critical in addressing corruption for both the researchers, but also for us who are the forefront of fighting corruption. Then the other issue which actually comes out of this, especially when you have this corrective action, is lack of sanctioning by the state. I know that many of the anti-corruption initiatives, whether in wildlife or the rest of our other fields, they are concentrating on the legal function, sanctioning. But I think it is very important also to look at the social sanctioning. That's the most critical. If I pick the money from the government, if I allowed illegal wildlife products to be trafficked through my boundaries, what will the society say? If the society is not going to bother, if the society is not going to, actually it's going to be on my side, like it is in many of our countries, based in Uganda, where it's one of the known destination for trafficking, then it means that someone may not think twice, because you know that it will not be societal sanction. The society is very critical in defining what is good, what is acceptable, and what is not. And it's very, very difficult to fight something which is acceptable, widely acceptable, because to mean that those who are fighting are going to be, overwhelmed and are not going to be fully supported. I think that is critical, which this framework brings on board. So is the society ready to sanction those whom we think are doing the wrong things? And if not, why would that, what will be done? Then there is also an issue which really comes out, which is very critical into this, especially wildlife, the perception of the community, citizen relationship with wildlife, because that one also informs that, informs their opinion, their perception, you know, their connectivity to wildlife, and how far and what extent can they get to support the fight against corruption, or the fight against illegal wildlife trade, trafficking or trade generally. Now, I'm currently working with the initiative titled Strengthening Systems and Public Accountability, Public Accountability. It's a USAID funded initiative to address corruption, but also to promote accountability in the private sector. Now, when you look at what we want to do on TEVA, you find that we are planning we are already doing some work around this, basing on this framework, supporting initiative that promotes social change. Now, there are two fundamental questions, maybe which need to be further scrutinized and maybe interrogated, because in the corrective action, it is assumed that there is some level of acceptability of corruption. But there is also a fundamental question. Is there a society that from its beginning has been accepting corruption? If that's not the case, maybe at one time all societies were resenting corruption. How come that society has come to be accepting? Because that one is critical as we are using this framework to understand the root cause of that change you see. Because maybe trying to address it without understanding, why would a society, is it a coping mechanism? Are people coping after this a failure, a dysfunctionality? For example, in enforcement, that has made people to just lose hope and lose focus. So that at the end of the day, they have seen that nothing much can be done, so they are coping. So if that is the case, then the root cause would be, I mean, can you address this the other side, responsiveness of the government, responsiveness of the institutions, so that you don't create a situation where, I mean, the rest of the people or the society have believed that corruption is the way to go, and that's the only way of achieving whatever you want to achieve. So I think that one has to be kept at the back of our mind. That society may be, there's nothing, none of the society is more prone than the other, but circumstances are forcing them, so that in this analysis, we go into that circumstance and try to address what really caused that generalized way of accepting that things are supposed to be done in the wrong way. So what can we do to reverse that trend is very important. And that's why we try to see, like in this program, we are trying to keep understanding the social norms, the behavior, that behavior drivers we're talking about. What causes those behavior? Through engaging, why would people, the public sector, the civil society, the general public, why would they behave that way? What can be done in order to change that attitude? We intend to have like integrity icons to profile those who have been involved or those who have decided to do the contrary to what many people may think to be the way to go or the way of life. How do we promote those ones? Because the media is full of people who are negative, who are actually famous for being negative. They have been corrupt. They have been voted into high positions. They actually be living huge and large and big. Then they become a good example. In other words, we are actually creating heroes. So on the other side, can we also create some heroes of those who may not have a lot of money, but they have integrity. So we have integrity icons, positive deviants, trying to identify them and being able to recognize them so that we can counter this negativity that has come and has become a part of the way to go. Sensitization of the public, but also building capacity in terms of how do actors try to, understand use of like this framework, understand how social norms can contribute to whatever vice we are talking about, the corruption in one life, how can it be actually used to turn things around? So we want to support those issues, but we are also intending to support accountability initiative. You know, there is sharing of resources that is generated from wildlife, from tourism. but even the communities don't get to know about them. They keep the negative attitudes towards wildlife, yet they actually are supposed to be benefiting, but because they don't see that money, then they keep that negativity, and that can help them to support actually the vice instead of fighting it. So we want to see and try to work with the civil society and other communities, conservationists, to ensure that we also try to ensure value for money from these resources. So by and large, this is a very good initiative. This is a very good framework. Further analysis is supposed to be done to understand these behavior changes we are seeing in our society and address those root causes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you very much. I in the questions and answers section, we have been seeing very good questions come in, very pointed questions, and Gil and Claudia have provided answers to that, which everyone can read and see. And unfortunately, this is a very interesting topic, and obviously I'd like to discuss it further with everyone here in the room, our time has ended. So I'd like to thank everyone, our panelists, for their presentation, our discussions, for their very pointed reflections. I want to thank our audience members for their engagement and their very good feedback questions. We hope this has inspired you to dig deeper into the research findings, and we very much look forward to staying in touch. And thank you very much again for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.